Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Emily Monassin. She's a member of the Ronin Institute for Independent Scholarship and an adjunct faculty member at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We're talking about her new book, Blight, Fungi and the Coming Pandemic. Emily, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Yeah, thanks for writing a really scary book.
Well,
what precipitated this?
It was a bunch of things. It was sort of slow coming. But I would say probably, I can't remember, 10, 12 years ago, when if anybody grows tomatoes, they might know that we have a problem with a thing called late blight, which is not actually a fungus, but it's a fungus-like organism. It's a Phytophthora infestans. And so anyway, that organism started infecting our tomatoes and killing them off in August, right when they were starting to get ripe. And it turns out that it was a disease that was new to the East Coast.
Oh, God.
And it was new because it probably traveled up the East Coast with big box store tomato plants. That's the thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's here to stay. So that kind of, and I just grow backyard tomatoes. But at that time, I went and spoke to our local farmer who was known for growing all sorts of varieties of tomatoes, and it was a big problem. So just that kind of opened my eyes to the problem of having that kind of pathogen. And then a couple of years after that, a whole consortia of scientists who work on fungi across species put out a paper and said, hey, you know, trying to get people to be aware of how important fungal pathogens are. And so, you know, I thought, well, maybe this is a time to write a book, but then I didn't. And then Candida auris happened, which is that human, the yeast that came, started, it kind of emerged in maybe around 2016 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I was like, okay, now, now's the time to do this.
Now, we should make a couple of things clear. First of all, do you pronounce it fungi or fungi?
I pronounce it fungi. I've been told by mycologists, because I am not a mycologist, kind of anything goes.
Okay. Now, the other thing that I think an awful lot of people don't realize this is that fungi aren't plants.
Right.
They're in their own kingdom.
So, yes, they have their own kingdom. It's a very diverse kingdom. I have also been told that, like, just within the yeast, which are the single-cell fungi that a lot of us are familiar with because we use them to bake bread, that the differences between yeasts are as big as, like, you know, can be as broad as between humans and fish. So there's a lot of different species and a lot of different diversity within the whole kingdom of fungi, which include mushrooms and molds and mildews. And yes, they're more closely related to animals than they are related to plants.
Now, you write in the very beginning of the book that infectious fungi and fungus-like pathogens are the most devastating disease agents known on the planet. And people were going to be really surprised to hear that because you don't hear a lot about fungi problems. Why are they more devastating than other things like viruses?
Because they have actually driven species into extinction. And as far as, you know, they've driven many different kinds of species into extinction. And I think the reason we don't necessarily hear about it is because they're more important in species other than humans. So crop plants, forests, and certain wildlife species. So that's what, I mean, in the book I do write about some species that have gone extinct because of fungal pathogens.
One of the nearest ones that a lot of people may be familiar with is they're essentially extinct is the American chestnut.
Yes. Yep.
People don't realize how common that tree was before the fungi come in.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that either, and I grew up in a place called Chestnut Hill. So, you know, if you think of all those places that are named Chestnut Lane and Chestnut Hill, and, you know, chestnuts were everywhere. They were all up, we were kind of getting close to the northern end of them. They run down through the Appalachians and along the East Coast. And, you know, depending on what you read, they were a large proportion of the forests in the Appalachian mountain chain. Chestnuts are everywhere. They were an important food source. They were big, beautiful old trees. They were very common. And I never knew that until, and there are remnants of these big old chestnuts in our forest still. You just have to know what to look for.
Right. There are these ghost trees that they talk about.
Most
of those are down, I think.
Yeah. Those are down and gone. And actually, they cut in a lot of places when that. Do you want me to tell the.
Sure, go ahead.
The fungus hit. It was back in the, now I'm trying to remember, like not around 19, early 1900s. Started, first noticed in the Bronx Zoo in New York City. And then when they realized that this was such a devastating disease, the chestnuts were just within a year. So it was first noticed that maybe there was something going on with the chestnut trees in the zoo, that their leaves started curling and they were dying. And a year later, they were dead. So, or something like that. And so when they realized it was such a devastating disease and that it was spreading and there was nothing people could do about it, and it was killing these big chestnuts, then they tried to stop the disease by kind of like a fire break. They started cutting down chestnut trees. And so that, both the cutting down of the chestnut trees trying to stop the fungus and the fungus just spreading like wildfire, killed off basically all of our American chestnut trees, and they're now called functionally extinct, which means...
You can see young ones, can't you?
You might see young ones, yes. So that's what, like, in our local forest, which I had never known until I was writing this book, you can see these kind of shrubby or young trees with these really big leaves. I don't know if you... Have you ever seen them?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. So, and I didn't even know what they were. I just thought that's a really kind of funny-looking leaf because they're really big and... and so anyway, those are the remnants, and those young chestnuts will grow for maybe 10 years, but then the fungus is still around, and so it will kill the tree once it gets to, you know, a certain size.
It's amazing, reading your book, one of my takeaways is that these infections caused by fungi are remarkably persistent and pernicious. It's like you can do everything you think it's possible to get rid of them, and they somehow bounce back.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things about certain kinds of fungal pathogens is their staying power, and that is in part because many of them make spores. So fungi reproduce by making spores, and they can send out hundreds of thousands and millions of spores, depending on the fungus, and some of those spores in the, you know, most recalcitrant fungi can last for decades. So it's once they get into the soil, they're pretty much there for good for a very long time.
There's a section of your book where people are trying to test how resistant fungi were to radiation. And basically they find out that they can really take a lot of radiation. So it is very tough to kill these fungi.
Yeah, I should say that's a certain kind of fungus. So that was one, you know, a kind of mold. I think it was a black mold that was very,
And that was the kind that showed up on the space station, the black mold.
Yes, and that's why they were studying it, to see if that kind of mold could withstand the radiation of space, because, you know, when things are in space, they're exposed to more radiation than things on Earth. So, yeah. Yeah, and they found that they were very resistant to radiation.
Somebody in the book that you quoted even suggested maybe they could survive outside the space station. That's how spooky some of these fungi are.
Yeah, I think so. I did interview two astrobiologists, and you know, one who studied that and said, you know, given the right conditions, they could possibly survive on the outside. But then someone else said, yeah, but that would be, you know, even if they did survive on the outside, for them to, you know, if you transported it to wherever that spacecraft lands, it would have to survive a lot of conditions to be able to grow and flourish. So, but yeah, they are remarkably resilient.
Yeah, the book starts off with an infection that I'm familiar with. And I've actually seen them out in winter, the bats out in winter that are suffering from this. And that's white nose syndrome. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So that's one where I write about just having, you know, watched our bats disappear in the mid-2000s.
It happened here, too, in Worcester.
Yeah, that you had noticed the disappearance of them.
The little brown miotas and all those other, they just went.
Yeah. And, you know, we used to just watch them pour out of our church, and then there were rumors that the church had, you know, blockaded the bats and kicked them out, but that's not what happened. It was Turns out a couple of years later, they realized it was this fungus, pseudogymna, I'm going to attempt to say the name. So fungi have very long, complicated names. This one, I think, is pseudogymnoascus destructans.
Yes, PD. That's it.
And it causes a disease called white nose syndrome. And it, like you say, you know, it's visible because you can see this little puffy white stuff on the bats if you see the bats that are suffering from it. And so it has devastated the bats. It's killed millions and millions of our East Coast bats, and it has since spread across the country. So it's a very frightening thing. And it impacts hibernating bats. So it's more of a problem for those bats, particularly in the probably northern parts, because they hibernate. And, you know, talk about fungal persistence. The problem is that the fungus is in the hibernicula where the bats go into their caves. The bats, if they can survive the winter survive the fungus throughout the winter and live in the spring, they do okay and they actually clear the fungus. But if they go back, when they go back to the hibernicula, the fungus is still there and will infect them.
And it's there on the floor, right? It's in the bat guano.
Yeah. I think there's, I can't remember, but I spoke to some scientists who were trying to figure out, you know, how it's living, what it's living on. It seems to live on skin and like exoskeletons of insects and things like that. So in the cave, it can survive on that, or maybe in spore form, I'm not sure. But yeah, during the, you know, months where the bats aren't there, it will survive. And so when they come back, it just kind of can reinfect them. And
one of the effects of it is that the bats start behaving abnormally. And one of the things I've seen, and I was told it was white nose syndrome, is I saw bats flying around like in the middle of January, which around here, especially well inland, as you are, as I am too, you don't see bats flying around. There's no insects for them to eat. But I've seen these singular bats just sort of whipping around in the middle of winter, and they look like one of the Miata species. They shouldn't be.
Wow.
And that's like the white nose syndrome.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty disturbing. I think the fungus, you know, they tend to wake or rouse out of their torpor. So when they're in the hibernicula, they are aroused more if they're infected with the fungus. And yeah, so one of the things is that they can try to go feed in a time when they shouldn't be.
Now, we should mention that a lot of fungi are perfectly fine, and we live with them all the time, and we eat them. But fungi include rusts, molds, mildews, and mushrooms. What are mushrooms, technically? They're just the flower, essentially, the flowering part of the mold, right?
They are different, so not necessarily mold. Like I said, I'm not a mycologist, but I did not write about mushrooms.
Well, I meant they're the fruiting body.
They're the fruiting bodies. So yes, and all fungus have some kind of fruiting body. And the ones that we recognize as mushrooms, the mushroom is the fruiting body. And those tend to be the mushrooms that grow, a lot of them are underground. They grow as the mycelia, they grow hyphae, they have mycelia. If you walk in the woods, you would notice, you know, the white strands on a dead log or something like that, mm-hmm. that might eventually sprout mushrooms. Or, you know, I always think it's fascinating when you see the trees with those lines, you know, you can just see the lines of fruiting bodies of mushrooms coming out of the trees.
That means
that underneath the bark, there's mycelia or, you know, hyphae growing underneath the bark there, and they pop out. But you wouldn't know that until they pop out and you see the fruiting bodies. So, yeah, but all of them, you know, some of them, yeasts just tend to just bud, so they kind of split in half, more like bacteria might. So there's all different ways, but yeah, when they make these fruiting bodies and molds, like you said, you know, they do too. They don't make things that we can always see, but they make these little, sacks full of spores that they released.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Emily Manassian. She's a member of the Ronin Institute for Independent Scholarship and an adjunct faculty member at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And we're talking about her new book, which is really, truly a little bit sobering, but fun to read. Still, it's scary. Blight, Fungi, and the Coming Pandemic. And speaking of which, you write about how some species of virulent fungi essentially took it, not purposely, but took advantage of the COVID in hospitals. And that story was incredibly scary.
Yeah, so that's one that really worries public health and physicians. So this is the yeast fungus. It's called Candida auris. It's a relatively newly emergent fungal pathogen. It was first recognized around 2016, maybe, as a in sort of hospital settings. I should mention that most of the – so humans are pretty resilient and we're pretty well protected against fungal pathogens because most fungi don't like our warm body temperatures. So we are not as much as at risk as many of the other species. And many fungi that infect humans tend to take advantage of those who are immunocompromised. So our immune system does a pretty good job at beating off fungal pathogens too. But if we have some kind of either, drug treatments or viruses or whatever that will, that impacts our immune system, then we tend to be more susceptible to fungal pathogens. And so that particular pathogen is very important in places where, with long-term healthcare settings, in places where people are have been there a while, that tend to be very sick. And so that emerged. And when it did, it was hard to, at first, it tended to be resistant to the few antifungal drugs that we have. So that was a problem. And it was hard to clear the room when they try to clean a room after somebody's been in it, it was hard to, sometimes the fungus was still there. But they finally solved that problem. They figured out how to disinfect the room. And so they were, I think in general, there was sort of awareness of this fungus and they were getting it under control. And then COVID happened. And then we all know what happened COVID happened. And, hospitals were overfilled and there was hygiene, but it was to control COVID. And there were a lot of very sick people, and there were people that were probably on, I'm not really sure, again, I'm not a mycologist, not a physician, but I think there were probably people that, might have been treated with steroids or whatever that might have possibly suppressed the immune system or whatever, and they had lung infections. And so it was just an opportunity for this fungus to just spread. And so it has. And we're in here, I'm talking about, thousands of cases, not like COVID where we had millions, but still it's spread. And now it's a problem throughout, first it started primarily on the East Coast. Now it's pretty much, I think, everywhere. It does tend to be more of a problem in long-term healthcare facilities, but yeah, it's very hard. It can be very hard to treat. So it's problematic.
It was interesting because we never heard anything about it during COVID.
Yeah.
I think everybody was so focused on COVID, nobody wanted to hear that the hospitals were having an additional problem that made everything worse.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that probably wasn't the only other additional problem.
But, oh, I'm
you
sure.
know, it was sort of the primary, the acute problem.
Now, two other fungal infections that I'm really interested in and that I've actually seen the results of are what's called the Great Frog Die-Off.
Yeah.
And what's called BD, which is the frog killer. Mm-hmm. How was this discovered?
That was a sort of, what do I want to say, like a slow-rolling story of noticing disappearances of frogs in places like Costa Rica and mm-hmm. Panama. Frog populations seemed to be disappearing, and nobody knew why, and there were all sorts of hypotheses about what was going on. And I did speak with a scientist, Karen Lips, who studied in those sites in the 90s, and she arrived to study a certain kind of frogs that was really cool. And
I think it was the golden frog, wasn't it? The golden frog in Costa Rica?
So that was the – I think that did happen to the golden frog – I think the one she was studying was, it was this spiny kind of
frog. Yeah.
That she thought was really
and she
cool
was like doing this year after year, and she knew where the frogs were. There was plenty of them. And then she came back one year, and they were mostly not there.
Yes, right. And so that sort of started her on, changing her whole research direction from, you know, studying the ecology of some cool frog to tracking the decline of frogs because of this BD fungus that was spreading throughout South America, Latin America, Central America, and even here. So it's a global. So this is the one that's a global pandemic. It's a fungus that has spread throughout the world. It has actually driven dozens, if not hundreds, of species. I can't remember exactly, into extinction, frog species, and threatening many others. So I'm curious, where did you see it?
I read about it. I mean, that's what I meant. I didn't see it. Well, I didn't see the frogs because they weren't there. I've been down in Costa Rica, and the frogs were sort of absent.
Yeah,
and there's a similar one written about in your book that's happening to salamanders in Europe. It's called BSAL. And essentially it's another fungal infection that's just wiping out all the salamanders.
Yeah, so it's a relative of the one that's wiping out the frogs. Similar, they're called chytrid fungi. They're actually flagellated aquatic fungi, which means they can kind of swim through the water. BSAL is killing salamanders in Europe, and there's a lot of fear that if that fungus travels here, which it could travel through the pet trade, which is how they think a lot of these some of these kinds of fungi travel through the pet trade. So if, say, an infected salamander comes here, we apparently, which I didn't know, in the Appalachian, we have like a huge, really important, diverse.
That's the most salamander species in the North America or in the Appalachian.
Yeah. 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 And so there's a lot of concern that they are at risk from BSAL because, you know, so there's been some efforts to try to, by Karen Lips, the one who studied frogs, now she's also working with salamanders because she's seen the devastation, trying to stop this BSAL from coming here and infecting the salamanders. And a whole group of wildlife conservation and academics and federal agencies work together. So there's now a ban on salamander species that are known to carry BSAL, so they can't be traded. But there are concerns that that's not, I think it's like 201 different salamander species cannot be imported here. The problem is there's always other species, salamander species, that may carry it.
You address this a lot in your book. People don't understand how widespread this trade in herps is, in reptiles and amphibians. I mean, it's crazy. It's like all over the world. People are paying exorbitant prices for rare species. And this stuff just gets traded across borders willy-nilly, and there's nobody to check it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are, you know, they're trying to keep illegal trade. They check that. And there's actually a book out, I can't remember what it's called, Trade or something, about this, about the animal trade and actually the, you know, how big it is and then the illegal animal trade. But even if we talk legal animal trade, yes, it's they don't really check species coming in, these kinds of species like frogs and salamanders, fish, for diseases. They just it's just not part of the certain fish. Actually, that's not true. Salmonids, because we care about our salmonids, trout, salmon.
Yeah.
There are some rules about that. But yeah, it's hard to imagine that, you know, but shipments of these animals can come in and there's no regulations that, you know, or they're not tested very carefully or at all sometimes for diseases. And this is how diseases get moved around.
Well, you talked to Megan Romberg, who's the only two national mycologists for the USDA.
Yeah.
So there's all these plants and animal stuff that's crossing our borders. They could be carrying fungi pathogens, but there's only two people to check.
Well, there's two people. She's the ultimate check, the final checker.
Yeah.
There are so plants. Do
but
come
she she's got her and, she's got her caseload. I mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's pretty much, she and her partner are pretty much overloaded. So when plants come in, they do get, you know, inspected to some degree. And if something is unknown, you know, someone tries to figure out what it is, and if they can't figure it out, they send it to her.
Wow.
And this all happens in a really short period of time. So, like, within, because they can't hold plants that are coming through for a really long time. We don't have, like, they have to get it to where they're going. So, but at least we have people like her who are doing that, and there is no, like, Megan Romberg and her, you know, cohort for animal trade, which is just, I found that hard to believe. Yeah.
We just have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about how to make things better and to prevent a coming pandemic of a fungal agent. And you write about how policymakers need to take seriously the links between human, animal, environmental health in relationship to disease emergence and spread, that they really need to understand this is an environmental problem, the reason that these things are happening.
Yeah. Yeah, we're all so connected, and we're not separate, and we all know the things we do have consequences. We see it in, you know, big things, climate change, things we can't see, spreading diseases to animals that we might not even be aware of. So, yeah, we need to be a lot more conscious and careful about how we move and live and trade and in the world.
That almost seems like that's way too much. or to be,
yeah.
I'm in sort of a dark mood anyways about the world at the moment, but it just, you really expect them to do that. It's like, no.
No, but, you know, even.
Are you still upbeat? Are you upbeat about the fact that that could happen?
Well, I mean, I was hoping. So
your voice went up.
The work they did with
your voice came up there, helpful. Emily.
Yeah. Well, I'm not. Okay. Well. You can only hope that we can do better, and that, you know, just raising awareness, maybe we can do better.
Like this book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to do an unadulterated plug, but this book is a good place for people to start to get aware of the problem. We're completely out of time. My guest tonight is writer Emily Monassen. She's a member of the Ronin Institute for Independent Scholarship and adjunct faculty member at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And her book is a great read. Blight. Fungi and the Coming Pandemic. Emily, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Mark, for helping to raise awareness.
Yes, we'll both do it. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.